Well, it shouldn't take long to finish this chapter because it's all just motions and pretty self-explanatory. I just want to demonstrate them, make sure you understand the pictures. We've already talked about flexions and extensions, which mostly occur in which plane? Sagittal plane, correct. And remember that flexion decreases the angle, extension brings it back, and hyperextension goes beyond. It's not always possible, but some things can be hyperextended. So don't think about flexion being in a certain direction with respect to the anatomical position. For instance, flexion of the hip brings the thigh anteriorly, but flexion of the knee brings the leg posteriorly. Notice in both cases, though, that the angle decreases in flexion. That's what makes it flexion. So don't think about it as being a direction. I think I also mentioned last time, I didn't show you slide 10, but I mentioned that abduction and adduction occur mostly in the coronal or frontal plane, and abduction is movement of that body part farther from the midline, whereas adduction brings it back closer to the midline. And so you can see abduction at the shoulder and adduction at the shoulder being demonstrated in that. Of course, you can also abduct and adduct the hip joint, as shown also in part A there. Movements, slide 11 now, movements that either movements in the superior or inferior direction are called elevations and depressions, respectively. Pretty self-descriptive. Elevation means to get higher. So movement toward the top, which is superiorly, is elevation, and movement inferiorly is depression. For instance, as demonstrated here, the shoulders can be elevated and depressed. So can the mandible, right? When you close your jaw, that's elevation of the mandible, or elevation actually at the temporomandibular joint, which is the joint between the skull and the rest of the skull and the mandible. Slide 12, protraction and retraction, another set of opposites. Protraction is movement anteriorly, and retraction is movement back to the anatomical position. You know, in other words, it's the undoing of protraction. So this guy is illustrating protraction of the shoulders and then retraction back toward the anatomical position. You can also do that with your jaw. Your jaw is a pretty complex set of joints, actually. So you can elevate and depress, like I was saying. That's just opening and closing of the jaw. But you can also jut your mandible out, which is protraction, and bring it back, which is retraction. No, that's not the only thing it can do, but let's just go in order here. Slide 13. This one isn't listed on the slide, but this motion being represented is called circumduction. And only ball and socket joints are able to do this, so you can do this with your shoulder and with your hip joints. Circumduction refers to, actually, it's a series of motions. If I trace out a circle with my hand the movement's actually occurring at my shoulder, but if I trace out a circle with my hand, really what I'm doing is a combination of flexion, abduction, extension, and then adduction over and over to do that. But we call that special series circumduction because you're moving in a circle. You can do the same thing with your thigh, with the hip joint, moving your thigh. 14 shows rotations also of the shoulder, but the same thing applies to the other ball and socket joint, the hip. So notice that the arrows are located on this model's elbow, but that's not where the rotation is occurring. It's just easier to understand that it's rotation if you first flex the elbow. Because when you do that, when you flex the elbow first and then move this way, it's easier to tell that the humerus is actually rotating in the socket here. So this isn't a motion of the elbow. I just bend the elbow first to show you that motion. It's rotation of the shoulder in both cases, but in this case we have either internal and external rotation are the opposites, or usually the better terms are medial and lateral rotation, as you see. So it's called medial rotation. Of course, a rotation doesn't really make sense to call it medial or lateral unless you have a reference point. The reference point is the front of the humerus, the front of the bone of the arm. All right. So when I do this, the front of that bone is moving medially, and that's why it's medial rotation. Whereas if I do this, the front of the bone is moving laterally. Of course, just the opposite is happening on the back of the bone, but that's not the reference point. So medial rotation is also called internal rotation. Lateral rotation is also called external rotation. And you can do the same thing with the hip. And it's just like it's easier to see that when you bend the elbow first. It's easier to see it in the hip if you bend the knee first, but it has nothing to do with the knee, right? These are the two motions. I realize that's not helpful on the recording, but that's one reason to attend. All right, 15, supination and pronation is another pair of opposites. And this is a pair that applies to a special movement that occurs at the elbow. When you think of the anatomical position, which remember is this, that is... If I were lying down on my back, but in the same position with respect to my limbs, with my palms facing the same direction, that would be called the supine position. Whereas if I were lying flat on my face, that would be called the prone position. Well, when you move your... When you rotate that pivot joint that we were talking about last time in the elbow so that your palm faces anteriorly, that is supination. Whereas when you do the opposite and rotate it up here but cause the palm to face posteriorly, that's pronation. Now it seems like I said before, it seems like that's happening, that's something that's occurring at the wrist, but the wrist isn't moving it at all in that. Well, I mean, it's not really the movement that's causing that. What's happening is that the radius, which you can see up there in upper right, the radius bone, which is one of the two antebrachial bones or forearm bones, the head of that radius, which is the proximal part of the bone, has a very shallow socket on which it rotates with respect to the knobby condyle. That's the distal part of the humerus. So the brachial bone, the arm bone, and one of the forearm bones, the radius, come together and form a pivot joint. When that twists, what happens is that the radius and ulna, which in the supine position are parallel to each other, cross each other. The ulna does not move, and I talked about this last time too. When I said you can demonstrate that by putting your elbow on a hard surface and you can still pronate and supinate, your ulna does not move at all. It's your radius that's twisting with respect to your humerus. And when that happens, the radius and ulna, which are normally parallel, cross each other. Well, the radius proximally is narrow, and when it gets to its distal end, it's much wider. That's just the opposite of the ulna. The ulna starts out very wide at the elbow, which is the proximal part of it, and then it narrows as it gets distal. That wide distal part of the radius is what is in contact with the wrist itself, which is made up skeletally of the carpal bones, our carpalia, as they're called. So the seven bones of the wrist, which are right here, are in contact with that broad end of the radius. And when that radius twists up here at the elbow, it's going to drag the wrist with it, basically, at the distal end. That's what's happening in pronation. So I'm supinated right now. When I do this, I'm pronating. All right, 16. Flexion can also occur. Well, I demonstrated flexion of the hip before when I lifted my thigh. That's actually exactly the same movement as flexion of the hip to bring my trunk down, to bend over. The only difference is what is stationary and what is moving. If I keep my feet on the ground and therefore my thigh is stationary, flexion at the hip will cause me my trunk to bend over. But it's exactly the same motion as if I do this, right? It's just my trunk is now stationary, so my thigh is the thing moving. Flexion also, though, applies to the vertebral column. In other words, you can hunch your back. That's because you are causing a bunch of little flexions between the vertebrae. That's different from just keeping your back straight and bending just at the hips. But they're both flexions, reasonably so, because they're occurring in the sagittal plane. Extensions undo those. But the vertebral column also can undergo lateral flexion, which is bending it to the side, as demonstrated there. And because of the fact that these intervertebral discs are more or less flat pads that can rotate just a little bit with respect to each other. So it's not much rotation at each joint, but there's 23 joints that can pivot that way. So it can add up to quite a bit of rotation along the vertebral column as well. But rotation doesn't apply just to the spine or the vertebral column, of course. Various things can rotate, like the neck. Protraction and retraction of the mandible are shown in 17, or the jaw, I should say, the jaw joint, temporomandibular joint. Excursion is also yet another type of movement that the jaw can perform. So that's moving to the left or the right, like this. If the jaw were just a simple hinge, you would have a much harder time dealing with food. You're able to do a lot of very intricate movements with the jaw, not just for chewing food, but that's an important part of having a jaw, of course. So lateral excursion, medial excursion, pretty self-explanatory, away from the midline or toward the midline. That was slide 17. 18 shows you some special movements that occur involving the hand. Now, the A is labeled here in this book as, well, A and B, as radial flexion and ulnar flexion, respectively. That's this motion and this motion. But notice that if I'm in the anatomical position and I do this, what I'm doing is bending the wrist, by the way, in what plane? I'm not talking about bending the wrist this way, which is the sagittal plane. Which way am I bending the wrist? Which plane? Which one? In the frontal or coronal plane, exactly. So you would think that that would qualify as what kind of movements? Frontal and coronal plane. Based on what you were just taught. Abduction and adduction, right. So this book calls this movement radial flexion, even though it's in the coronal plane. Other books, more reasonably, and I think better, call that just abduction of the wrist. And this is adduction of the wrist. Right? That makes sense. That goes along with the somewhat standard notion of having movements within the coronal plane being abductions and adductions. But the reason it's called radial flexion, as opposed to ulnar, is because it's movement in the direction of the radius. In the anatomical position, the radius is laterally placed and the ulna is medially placed. No matter what position you're in, your radius always corresponds to your thumb. whether you're pronated or supinated. So in the anatomical position, the radius is this side, and therefore this movement, according to this book, is radial flexion. Ulnar flexion, movement toward the ulna, the other way. There's also abduction of the digits. You can do this with fingers or toes. So that's spreading the digits apart, right? That's abduction. Here it's not the midline of the body, which it is in most other abductions that you're referencing. Here it's the midline of the actual limb. So there's a midline of my hand, right? And if I spread my fingers apart, I'm moving them all farther away from that midline. So that's abduction of the digits. Abduction brings them back. Same thing with the toes. The palmar abduction of the thumb in D that's being represented here, that's not this. What I just did right now is just abduction, right? Normal abduction, which is in a coronal plane. But I can also move my thumb from the anatomical position anteriorly, right? Which is away from the palm in this direction. That's what's being illustrated there. So that's at right angles to normal abduction, but it's still called an abduction. It's palmar abduction because you're taking it away from the palm. And then finally, in E, you have another pair of opposites, even though only one of them is shown. Those are called opposition and reposition. We have an opposable thumb because we can undergo opposition with it, which is to take the thumb and touch the pinky, the tip of the pinky with it. Not all limbed organisms can do that. That's a special thing for us and related organisms. So that is opposition. Reposition just brings it back to the anatomical position. 19 shows you some special words used for what's happening at the ankle. Normally, we would have flexion occurring in a sagittal plane, and then the opposite of that would be extension. But in the case of the ankle, both of them are special cases of flexion. At least that's how we've named them. So there is what's called dorsiflexion and what's called plantar flexion. Dorsiflexion is called that because what ends up happening is that the toes, which are not really what's moving here, it's the ankle that's moving, but the toes end up being moved toward the dorsum, which is the back side of you, right? And in plantar flexion, plantar means of the sole of the foot. Like a plantar wart is a wart that occurs on the sole of the foot. So plantar flexion is movement of the ankle in the opposite directions. It ends up pointing the toes downward. And then inversion and eversion are also opposites of each other. Those would normally be called an abduction and an adduction because they're occurring in the coronal plane as well. But eversion is moving the ankle so that the sole faces laterally. And inversion is moving the ankle so that the sole faces medially. Which you can do a lot more than eversion. Most people can invert a lot more than they can evert. Oh, that's one chapter. Thank you.